From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, some great music for the holiday. First, we feature our concert and interview with jazz pianist Dave McKenna in celebration of his 70th birthday, which is tomorrow. Jazz critic Whitney Balliot described McKenna as the hardest swinging pianist of all time. We're listening to him now. McKenna has a new CD with singer Daryl Sherman. Later, we'll feature an excerpt of her Fresh Air concert. And we'll play back our 1985 interview with clarinetist and bandleader Artie Shaw. He turned 90 last week. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton observed Memorial Day at Arlington National Cemetery, laying the traditional wreath at the Tomb of the Unknowns.
If those who fought and died for us could talk to us on this Memorial Day, they might well ask, America, have you made our sacrifice matter? At the dawn of a new century, Americans can answer that question with solemn pride. Today, we are fortunate to be the most powerful and prosperous nation on earth, with the military respected around the world. We could say, yes, America has made your sacrifice matter.
The president also promised the nation will remain committed to the search for lost American war dead. He announced that the U.S. and North Korea have agreed to resume talks on recovering the remains of American soldiers missing in action during the Korean War. More than 8,000 Americans are still listed as missing from the Korean War between 1950 and 1953. Teams of U.S. and North Korean officials have recovered the remains of about 40 American soldiers over the past 4 years, but the joint recovery effort stalled last year. Now that rebels in Sierra Leone have freed all 500 UN peacekeepers, the main issue is what to do with the rebel leader, Fode Sanko, who's being held by the government. David Hecht reports.
West African leaders have announced that Fode Sanko will soon be taken out of Sierra Leone to a safe location. But some in the Sierra Leone government, including the foreign minister, do not seem to agree. The government has said that Sanko is soon to be put on trial. The West African leaders say they will not attempt to stop that process and will also create their own investigation into illegal diamond dealings in Sierra Leone, in which the rebel leader is deeply implicated. But also implicated is the president of Liberia, Charles Taylor, who has been allied to the rebels and believed to have supplied them with arms. He is now being hailed by the UN for having obtained the release of UN peacekeepers and may be the best person to patch up the tattered peace agreement between the government and rebels, unless, of course, he is also put on trial. For NPR News, I'm David Hecht.
Peace talks between Ethiopia and Eritrea have been postponed until tomorrow as fighting in the two-year border war continued. Talks were to have begun today in Algiers, but Ethiopia's foreign minister was delayed. In the meantime, Ethiopian MiG fighters struck at a military airstrip on the outskirts of the Eritrean capital, firing rockets and dropping bombs. Ethiopia has said its offensive won't stop until it has retaken all the borderland seized by Eritrea at the beginning of the war. The two nations on the Horn of Africa are among the poorest countries in the world, yet each side has poured hundreds of millions of dollars and thousands of lives into the conflict. Financial markets in the United States were closed today for the Memorial Day holiday. This is NPR News. After a violent weekend, the Lebanese government has closed off the area once occupied by Israel in southern Lebanon to all but local residents and the media. James Schofield reports from Beirut.
Today, the Christian village of Ramaysh resounded to the drums of an elaborate funeral cortege, with hundreds of local villagers turning out to pay their last respects to Georges Al-Haj, the man shot dead on Sunday by an armed Muslim civilian. The incident itself was an isolated case, but Christians in southern Lebanon feel vulnerable, having been first occupied and then abandoned by Israel, as they see it. They've appealed to the Lebanese government to deploy the army in their area as soon as possible. Lebanese authorities also hope to prevent trouble at another flashpoint along the border with Israel. Four Lebanese were wounded on Sunday when Israeli border guards fired plastic-coated rubber bullets at a crowd of demonstrators. The United Nations has asked Jerusalem to order its troops to exercise restraint. For NPR News, I'm James Schofield in Beirut.
Officials in the Canadian province of Ontario announced new steps today to improve testing of drinking water after 5 people died from drinking water contaminated with the E. coli bacteria. The outbreak, which made hundreds of people ill, has been called one of the worst cases of E. coli contamination in North America. Ontario's environment minister said the new regulations will improve water testing and speed up reporting when water sources are found to be contaminated. The outbreak struck in Walkerton, about 90 miles west of Toronto. A class action lawsuit accused officials of failing to notify residents for days after it was learned that the town wells were contaminated. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this Memorial Day, we have some great music, a concert, and interview with Dave McKenna, the pianist described by Whitney Balliot as the hardest swinging jazz pianist of all time. As jazz critic Dan Morgenstern has said, McKenna's singular artistry covers the whole vocabulary of piano, from stride to bop. We often play McKenna's recordings on our show. He's a remarkable interpreter of songs and has a huge repertoire of them. He has 2 new CDs, Clarinet Blue, which also features clarinetist Bobby Gordon, and Jubilee, which also features singer Daryl Sherman, who we'll hear from later today. Our concert with Dave McKenna was recorded in 1988. We're playing it in celebration of his 70th birthday, which is tomorrow. Dave McKenna, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a complete pleasure to have you here.
Thanks, Terry.
And I'd like to ask you to introduce the first song you'd like to play.
Okay, this is a tune by Dietzen Schwartz called By Myself.
That's beautiful. You know, I especially like hearing you perform solo. And I think the reason is that Your sense of rhythm is so strong. It's like you're accompanying yourself. And I just assume not hear anybody with you so I can hear completely what it is you're doing, and I was wondering if you especially like playing solo.
Well, of course, it's the way I make my living now. But it's fun to play with a band. I don't... the bass-piano duo thing or the piano-trio thing doesn't work with me because it's that in-between thing. I don't think I ever got that down. But I really love playing with bass and drums and a horn or two, you know, trumpet and saxophone and some, a guitar, too. I love that. But I play it a different way then, and it's just, it really is fun. But anything less than four pieces, I'd rather be alone, I think, because I can, it's great working with good bass players, and there are plenty of them now, and drummers, but this way I can change tempo. I'd have to work with a bass player for years and just change or change tunes, you know, and you, when you play solo, you just, a lot of it is just killing time, killing the clock.
You think so?
Yeah.
Would you play another song for us?
Sure.
That was Yours Is My Heart Alone, performed live by pianist Dave McKenna. When you're playing a song, do you usually know the lyrics to it?
Well, I didn't used to know. I don't think I know the words to one song all the way through. But, you know, I do like to listen to singers, and bits and pieces of the words come back to me. And it's nice when you know a few. I think it
does
really
it help with
you,
the interpretation?
I think so. I think it helps play, helps you to play the melody better.
Mm-hmm.
But... I do remember a few of the words now. Never used to.
Do you like to learn a song from just hearing it or from sheet music?
I'm a bad sight reader. I just rather hear it, from somebody. The trouble is now that Well, to hear a song, I don't learn many new songs, to tell you the truth, because there are a lot of good rock songs and there are a few top 40 things, but they need guitars or singers or something. There aren't many tunes that really sound good on the piano that are being written now. But I suppose there are a few, and once in a while, somebody asks me to learn something, so I get the sheet music. But even then, I'd rather hear somebody play it or sing it before I play it.
We're listening to a 1988 concert and interview with pianist Dave McKenna. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Pianist Dave McKenna celebrates his 70th birthday tomorrow. We're celebrating with a 1988 concert and interview that he recorded in the Fresh Air studio.
I'm going to ask you to play another song. You want to do Sweet Lorraine?
Yeah.
Performed for us live by Dave McKenna. You know, I saw you perform once at a club in Cape Cod, and the room was filled. You were staring off into space, not intentionally, I thought, not making eye contact. with anybody, you know, just focused on nothing in particular, but obviously very, very focused, but really avoiding people's
eyes. Was
that
the Capitol and L House?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, that was a fun, that's a nice place, and for years the family, great friends of mine, they're wonderful people, the Lumens that ran it, but that gig, people did listen a lot there.
Oh, yeah, no, it was,
and it was like
quiet.
A concert. And,
but
I
it
mean,
seemed to
times,
me you just didn't want to see anybody.
Some nights were noisy. Well, yeah, when
you're
playing in those circumstances and everybody's listening, how they say, I'm saying to myself, oh, gee, what am I going to, how am I going to fill up an hour if these people are listening intently? So when I'm looking over in the space, I'm thinking of medleys to play, things that'll wind the clock down, you know? I really am.
Well, I don't fully understand, yeah.
Getting things together to play. You know?
Uh-huh. It amazes me that you're worried about people listening intently.
Well, no, I'm not worried about it. If they want to, I'll play. But you have to work harder then.
Right, I see. Okay. All right. You know, sitting right next to you at the piano, I'm really watching your hands carefully. And you have such a strong left hand when I hear your records. And your left hand is almost gently approaching the keyboard. I mean, you don't seem to be exerting yourself with your left hand at all.
You
have a very gentle touch.
I try to work hard. I'm not really adept. I can play, if I play it with some strength, then it gets kind of sloppy. I came to stride piano late. I only use it for a few bars at a time, but that's real work. I stand in awe of those guys that play it all the time, you know. Ralph Sutton, Dick Wellstone.
Yeah, yeah.
They really play it hard and accurately, you know. And
is accurate hard when you're playing stride?
Yeah, I think so. Because they've been playing it a long time. You know, some guys made a specialty of it, and their whole career was based on that. You know, the older guys, Fats and James P., those are the guys that invented it, I guess. And but as far as the working bass, that sort of just playing bass notes, that just seemed to come naturally to me, and it's not much exertion required there.
Were you self-taught, or was there a pianist who
studied
carefully with?
I had lessons from my first teachers were the nuns and parochials. I went to my mother's a real good musician, though. She played piano and violin, but she didn't want to teach, so she sent me the nuns, and I didn't really like to practice, but I could always pick tunes out that I heard on the radio and always played by ear, it seems, since I was about 7 years old. So I had a couple of good teachers, a guy in Boston, Sandy Sandiford, who was a jazz musician of sorts. I mean, he was a good jazz player, but he made his living writing showbiz charts for the singers around Boston. But he didn't, I was 16 or so by the time I went to him, and he didn't really fool with the way I played. He just made a few suggestions into how to organize it, and he said, why don't you make a little arrangement of this? And the lessons were kind of spotty because I was still living in my parents' house, and I didn't get up there often. But he had some nice suggestions anyway.
We're going to have time for one more song, and can I make a request?
Yeah.
Would you play Thanks for the Memory?
Of course. Thank you.
was great. Do you have a good musical memory? Do you know lots and lots and lots of songs?
I think I knew quite a few. I'm not one of the champions, though. Guys like Jimmy Rolls, I don't know how many, Men of a Thousand Tunes. But I knew quite a few, and it doesn't seem, though, as if I've been adding to the repertoire lately. I don't learn too many new songs. But a lot of the tunes I've been playing, I think I've known since I was 12 years old. That's not one of them, though. I never realized I liked the tune until, I don't know, I heard somebody do it, and that's when I came upon fairly late. Although I'd heard of it, you know, being a Bob Hope theme and all.
Well, I want to thank you so very much for joining us for this concert. It's really been a pleasure to have you here. And I want to say you've helped me hear a lot of songs in fresh ways through your interpretations of them. So thank you. Thank you very much for all your playing and for doing the concert today.
Thank you, Terry. I enjoyed it.
Pianist Dave McKenna recorded in 1988. Tomorrow is his 70th birthday. Happy birthday, Dave. He has a new CD with singer Daryl Sherman, who we'll hear from later on the show. It's called Jubilee. And he has a new CD with clarinetist Bobby Gordon called Clarinet Blue. Here's a track from it. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from Random House Inc.'s Delta Trade Paperbacks Division, publisher of Protecting the Gift, A Parent's Guide to Keeping Children and Teenagers Safe by Gavin DeBecker. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, an excerpt of our 1998 concert and interview with singer Daryl Sherman. She has a new CD with Dave McKenna. Also, a 1985 interview with Artie Shaw, the clarinetist and bandleader just turned 90. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Daryl Sherman is a jazz singer who performs at clubs and cabarets and has made several recordings. She has a lovely, warm voice and a great repertoire of songs, which she shows off at her regular gig at the Waldorf Hotel in New York. We're going to hear an excerpt of her 1998 Fresh Air concert. But first, let's hear a track from her new CD, which also features pianist Dave McKenna, who we just heard from. They grew up in the same town, Woonsocket, Rhode Island, and she considers him her hero. Although their families were very close, she didn't meet McKenna until she moved to New York in 1974. Their new CD celebrates the recent centennials of Duke Ellington, Noel Coward, Fred Astaire, and Hoagie Carmichael. Let's hear a song from it. This is Ellington's It's Kind of Lonesome Out Tonight. Wish I had a place to walk to. Wish there was a star inside. Wish I had a friend to talk to. It's kind of lonesome out tonight. Wish it wasn't getting colder. Wish the moon would give some light. Wish my head could find a shoulder. It's kind of lonesome out tonight. I look at the passing lovers that slowly wander by. My heart shakes its head and whispers, how many times can I die? Wish I knew some lips to borrow. Wish some would hold me tight. How I wish it was tomorrow. It's kind of lonesome out tonight.
Daryl Sherman and pianist Dave McKenna from the new CD, Jubilee. Sherman joined us at the piano in 1998 to perform and talk about her singing and her repertoire of jazz and pop songs. You got introduced to this kind of music very early on in your life because your father is a musician. He's a trombone player. Sammy Sherman, is that his name?
That's his name, Sammy.
And he led his own band as well as playing trombone?
He had a combo, I guess that's what they called it. Then when I was growing up, he played with quartets and quintets. And before I was born, he played with some bands. He played with the Buddy Morrow Band and Sonny Dunham Band. But I was pretty lucky because he would come home from a weekend gig and I would be the kid awakened at 1 in the morning or 2 in the morning if he'd bring some musicians home and have me sing for the company or something. And
what was in your repertoire back then?
Oh, gosh, I'm dating myself. Unfortunately, Somewhere Over the Rainbow. I think every kid wanted to be Dorothy. but he would sit me down at the piano. We had a piano, even though he didn't play the piano. He gave me one of the most valuable gifts by teaching me how to play triads, which is just basically three-note chords, and helping me to accompany myself, because really my first love was singing. And he was both my probably best fan and severest critic. He said, I don't want you being an amateur. You have to know, if you're going to be a singer, you have to know what keys you sing in, and you have to know the terms like taking it out, which is ending the song, or go to the bridge, or go to the release. And he was really strict with me about that, and I'm grateful for it now.
Now, Daryl, an earlier CD of yours was just all songs associated with Mildred Bailey, the singer who recorded in the 30s, 40s, and 50s as well.
Well, not really. She died around 1951. Essentially, she died at age 44 or 45, about the same age that Billie Holiday died. But her main period was in the 30s and the 40s.
Tell me what has made her an important figure to you musically.
Well, first of all, she was a very significant singer in the world of jazz, even though her name is not as well known as Billie's or Ella's or Sarah's. She was a great influence on them, and she was the first band singer. The band in question was the Paul Whiteman Orchestra, and it was with the Paul Whiteman Orchestra that she met her husband, the first man to play jazz on a xylophone, Red Norvo. And together they had a great career performing and recording. And there's something about her. I heard Rosemary Clooney in an interview once mention that she took elegant liberty with the songs, with her phrasing. She was a little ahead of her time. She wasn't a scat singer, but she knew how to phrase and how to make the stuff really swing. And I think even more significant, my relationship to her is she didn't have that stereotypical, traditional jazz sound, the sound that people associate, the sort of husky, bluesy sound. She had a girlish sound. More, even though she was not a soprano, but the timbre made it sound that way. And, of course, I can relate to that.
She had a great repertoire of songs, as you mentioned, and a combination of, like, ballads and swing tunes and novelty tunes. Maybe you could do an excerpt of a couple of her songs, of the songs she sang.
Well, the song that she was most associated with was Hoagy Carmichael's Rockin' Chair. She was called the Rockin' Chair Lady, so I'll give you a little of that. Old rockin' chairs got me, cane by my side. Fetch me that gin, son, for I tan your hide. Can't get from this cabin, ain't going nowhere. Just sitting here grabbing at the flies round my rocking chair. She introduced songs that sometimes became hits for other people.
There's another song I'm hoping that you could do a few bars of that Mildred Bailey helped to make famous, and the song is Lover Come Back to Me.
Oh, yes, Lover Come Back to Me is really a favorite of mine, too, and it was Mildred's signature song. She used to end most of her sets with it. I remember every little thing you used to do. So lonely. Every road I walked along with you. No wonder I am lonely. The sky is blue. The night is cold. The moon is new. But love is old. So while I'm waiting here, this heart of mine is singing. Oh lover, come back to me.
My guest is singer and pianist Daryl Sherman. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1998 interview in concert with jazz singer Daryl Sherman. Earlier we were talking about songs, and you mentioned a song, Isn't It a Pity, that you really love, and you were saying that you hear it differently now than you did when you started singing it. And since you were talking about the important thing being the meaning of the lyric to you, I thought you could tell us a little bit about how the meaning of that song has changed for you, and then maybe you could sing it for us.
Well, first of all, just as I say, growing into songs and finding even a different way with them musically. Sometimes if you change the key, that can change the whole flavor of it. But your perspective at 22 is not the same as it is when you're 42. And in this case, in this song, I think of this as a, more of a middle-aged love song. Anyway, and it's also, just in its own right, by George and Ira Gershwin, just a splendid song.
Would you play it for us?
I'd be delighted. Why did I wander here and there and yonder, wasting precious time for no reason or rhyme? Isn't it a pity? Isn't it a crime? My journey's ended. Everything is splendid. Meeting you today has given me a wonderful idea. Here I stay. It's a funny thing. I look at you, I get a thrill I never knew. Isn't it a pity we never met before? Here we are at last. It's like a dream. The two of us, a perfect team. And it's such a pity we never met before. Imagine all the lonely years we've wasted. You with the neighbors, I at silly labor. Joys untasted. You reading Heine, I somewhere in China. Happiest of girls I'm sure to be. If only you would say to me, it's an awful pity we never, never met before. Fishing for salmon, losing. losing at backgammon. What joy is untasted? My nights were sour, spent with Schopenhauer. Let's forget the past, let's both agree that I'm for you and you're for me. And it's such a pity we'll never, never met
Daryl Sherman, recorded in 1998. She performs regularly at the Waldorf in New York. She has a new CD with pianist Dave McKenna called Jubilee. They'll perform together at the Algonquin Hotel in New York for a couple of weeks in August. Coming up, a 1985 interview with Artie Shaw, who just turned 90. This is Fresh Air. Bandleader, clarinetist, and arranger Artie Shaw turned 90 last Tuesday. He led one of the most popular big bands of the 30s and 40s. The Shaw Band made one of its most popular records at its first recording session in 1938. It was a song by Cole Porter that was virtually unknown at the time, called Begin the Begin. Artie Shaw's huge popular success brought unexpected torments. He temporarily left music in 1939, frustrated with a performing career that depended on what he described as 90% business and 10% art. That was neither the first nor the last time he left music. In 1954, at the age of 44, Shaw began a nearly 30-year retirement from music and permanently gave up the clarinet. After writing two books and becoming a film producer, in 1980, Shaw returned to music for a few years. He organized a new big band, although he chose another musician, Dick Johnson, to play the solo clarinet parts and front the band. In fact, Daryl Sherman, who we just heard from, sang with that band. I spoke with Artie Shaw in 1985. The early bands that you played with were bands that you called entertaining bands. Like,
that's all there was. Yeah. There were no jazz bands then that you could make a living in. I mean, if you were lucky enough to be black, you could play jazz, because that's the only music they had in the ghettos. But I was playing in the white world. And in the white world, there was no room to play jazz and make a living. So I ended up at the best jobs there were, studio work. And there it got to be utterly incredible. You were playing things like Manhattan Merry-Go-Round, the Lucky Strike Hit Parade. Well, scary. You're playing as a true for true what they like. What was it true what they say about Dixie for 13 weeks in a row? That can be enough to drive any halfway decent musician clear out of his head.
You had said that when you were playing for the entertaining bands that you started to really hate the whole concept of showmanship.
I still do.
What were the kinds of showmanship antics that people in the band were called on to perform?
Glenn Miller's band waving the trombones around from side to side as they play, saxophones holding their instruments up in the air and doing everything but playing serious music. The guys in my band one night, I came back to the band. I'd left them for about 3 weeks. They were out on the road. And they were playing a tune that I wrote for the band called, an arrangement I made called Lady Be Good. At the end of the last chorus, the band does something, the saxophones do a fast kind of whinny trill. And the guys, for kicks, were holding their horns up, and the trombones were doing that. And I looked at them, and I was appalled. I said, what are you guys doing? They said, oh, it's for fun. I said, the audience doesn't know it's fun. They think you're doing showmanship. And if we have to do showmanship, that means we're very insecure about the music. Sit down and respect what you do. If you don't, they won't. And they heard that.
In the 30s and early 40s, a common question that people would ask was, well, who do you think is really the king? Is it Artie or Benny? Were you aware of that whole public competition?
How could
between
I not
you and
be?
Benny?
I was part of that controversy. It makes no bloody sense. We weren't doing the same things. The fact is we played a clarinet. We each played a clarinet, but the music was different. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you an interesting little anecdote. I had occasion to talk to Benny about something once that I wanted to do, and I needed him, and I needed the Dorsey people, and I needed the Stan Kenton and Guy Lombardo and all of the big band leaders. And I got okay from everybody. Goodman didn't want to do it. And he kept asking me questions about clarinet players. What do you think about so-and-so? What do you think about this guy, that guy? I said, this guy's too schmaltzy, that guy's too rigid, knowing what he expected me to say, and I was zinging him a little bit. And so I said, finally, Benny, you're too hung up on the clarinet. And he looked at me and says, that's what we do, isn't it? I said, no, I'm trying to play music. I'm not interested in clarinet. It's a means. It's an instrument. You use an instrument to do something with. And I saw a tiny light bulb go on in his eyes. I don't think he'd ever seriously considered the idea that the clarinet was a means, not an end.
When you were leading a jazz band, the bands were still pretty segregated. There were black bands and white bands.
In New York City, there was a local union, 802, white. Then there was a Harlem union for blacks. There was no way if you could mix. The only thing you could do on records now and then, you'd play with a black guy. I'd get on a record. There would be Coleman Hawkins there or Lester or whoever, Cozy Cole playing drums. Rarely was there a white. Well, there were no black playing with white musicians.
Well, when you hired Billie Holiday, she was, I believe, the first black singer to perform with a white
band.
Well,
to work in a white band, Studley, sure, as a member of the band. She didn't come out as a specialty act. See, I mean, when Benny Goodman had, say, Lionel and Teddy Wilson, they came out as a separate thing. They weren't in the band. When I had Lips Page, he sat in the band. Roy Eldridge was in the band. I had Zooty Singleton in my band in 1937. Well, that was unheard of. We played the Million Dollar Pier. People said, isn't he a black man? I said, well, he's hardly that tan. But it was very, very nip and tuck. People used very, very angry at it.
Were there places you couldn't play with Billie Holiday?
No. We went to the South. That was difficult because Billie had a short fuse and people would say things about it and she would blow. So I always had a guy ready to spirit her away, put her in a bus and get her out because she would blow. She'd call a guy every kind of MF you could think of. And they didn't take that too well. See, they would refer to as, they would say, have the nigger wench sing another song. I couldn't believe my ears. I'd say, you mean Billie singing another song? No, the nigger wench. That's what they thought of her as.
You enlisted during World War II and ended up playing with your band on
the Pacific
Front.
Yeah.
Did you know when you enlisted that you'd be mostly performing? Was that the arrangement that was made?
No, I had no idea what I was going to be doing. I was on the stage in Providence, Rhode Island, when I went back in the wings while a dance act went on. We were doing an hour show, as they called it. And the stagehand's radio was on, and we were hearing a hysterical announcer talking about the Japs having bombed Pearl Harbor. I had to go back out on stage. Just before I went out, I got a note from the manager, please announce that all military personnel is to report to its bases immediately. This was right near Newport, where there was a sub base, a naval base, an Air Force base, all that. So I went out on stage and did that, and about three-quarters of the house got empty. I hadn't realized, you know, you take it for granted men were more and more people showing up in uniforms. World War II was out there, but it seemed somehow distant. And when the Japs attacked Pearl Harbor, I suddenly had to see myself. I got a kind of Satori view of myself going out there and saying, now, ladies and gentlemen, our next tune will be. It sounded so irrelevant to this conflagration that World War II represented to me that I thought, I can't do this. I did it, announced the tune. I think it was Stardust. And as the band started playing, I turned to Les Robinson, who was in the first row of saxophone players. He was lead. And I said, Les, pass the word, 2 weeks' notice. Total impulse. And 3 weeks later, I was down on Church Street enlisting in the Navy. And I went in as an apprentice seaman, as low as you could get. I could have become a commander if I'd wanted to. I didn't know that. I knew Forrestal, who was then undersecretary. And when I joined up, I had seen him. And he said, if you get in trouble, come see me. Well, after about 6 or 8 weeks of minesweeper duty or Staten Island, this, that, and the other, I found myself doing what an apprentice seaman does. I thought the Navy would have enough rationality to put me into the job I could do best for them and then give me whatever rate or rank I needed for that. I was very naive, you know. I didn't realize that the military service doesn't operate rationally. They looked at one stripe or no stripe, and they gave me a swab the deck sailor. Well, that's kind of stupid. I was building shelves under a stairway to put mops and buckets on. So I went to see Forrestal. I went AWOL, went down there and saw him in his office. And he laughed, and he said, all right, I'll put you in touch with somebody. And I got in touch with the head of enlisted men, a man named Admiral Bledsoe. And he gave me carte blanche to get a band together. He said, what do you want to do? I said, what do you want me to do? He said, get a band together. It's the best you can do for us. Where? I said, where's the Navy? He said, in the Pacific. I said, okay. So he gave me total carte blanche. I enlisted a bunch of guys who were 1A and got the best band that ever was. That band was a tremendous band. We won the Esquire Poll and all that. We traveled all over the Pacific in places where the Bob Hopes couldn't go. We went to forward areas. We were on battleships. We were on aircraft carriers. We were all over the place.
Clarinetist and band leader Artie Shaw recorded in 1985. Last week, he celebrated his 90th birthday. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House Incorporated, Bantam Books Division, publisher of Flags of Our Fathers by James Bradley with Ron Powers, a story of the men who raised the flag on Iwo Jima. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Eddie Izzard has been described as Britain's special gift to stand-up, fall-down, knockout theatrical comedy. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with him about his comedy and his adventures as a transvestite. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.